the destruction of the first temple, which is the event that I'm going to discuss with you tonight, has to be viewed not only in a political and diplomatic and military and national sense, but it has to be viewed in a cosmic, spiritual sense, which is how Chazal, how our rabbis looked at the matter, and therefore were able to lend to it a an aura that not only made it special, if one could use that word, or made it something to be remembered, but they pointed out that it was a change in nature. It's not just a change in society or in political power in the world. It's not the destruction of the Roman Empire, the fall of Rome, and it's not the destruction of Berlin. It's not just that the Jewish people were defeated, but that it is compared to a change in all of nature, a change in all of the world. And we'll see that in certain ideas that the rabbis have told us that I wish to share with you because of the fact that it has, I believe, a clear insight into the Jewish view of history generally, and certainly the Jewish view of the destruction of the temple. The facts of the matter are, relatively speaking, simple enough. The Novi Yirmio had warned all of the years that the Jewish people were living, the kingdom of Yehuda was living in a false sense of security, that somehow they felt that they would be able to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, against the power of Babel, and the Jewish people would be able to sustain such a rebellion. They deluded themselves to think that Egypt would protect them. They said, much as you hear in the news today, that Egypt needed Israel, though a great power needs a small power. Small powers like to think that way, but in the reality of real politic, the great powers don't need the small powers at any time. And they deluded themselves to think that Egypt would rather fight Babel north of Jerusalem than to fight it on its own borders. Mitzrayim was not willing to do anything like that. Mitzrayim was perfectly willing to allow Babel to destroy Yerushalayim and destroy the kingdom of Yehuda, and to attempt later to come to its own accommodation, which it was never really able to, but they were not willing to spill one drop of Egyptian blood on behalf of the kingdom of Judah. The other delusion was that somehow Nebuchadnezzar would forget about them. He would allow the rebellion to go unchecked. He would allow the rebellion to take its natural course, and that the He was busy with other things, with more important things, with bigger matters, and therefore he couldn't be bothered by such a small event as a little country that had previously been a puppet of his now asserting some sort of rule. It was the same type of delusion, if we want to put it in modern, in a modern frame of reference, Czechoslovakia in 1968. What difference does it make to the Soviet Union if the system in Czechoslovakia changed, if it became more relaxed, if Dubček took power? What was the problem? Or Hungary in 1956? Or Poland today? There is no reason to fear any of that. And because of that, so they felt certain that Nebuchadnezzar would not expend the personal and national energy necessary to put down the rebellion. Throughout the history of humanity, small countries that have mounted such rebellions have always had that in the back of their mind, that somehow they weren't worth the effort of the large country to put the rebellion down. We'll see that in the time of the Second Temple, after the destruction of the Second Temple, when Bar Kokhba made an initially successful rebellion against the Romans. He also deluded himself to think that the Romans weren't going to send extra legions and make a great effort to put it down. It just wasn't worth it. History has shown us that that is a profound error. And the king of Bovel would not allow Yerushalayim to slip out of his orbit, and he would not allow Tzidkio to breach his oath of fealty to him. And he came with his whole army, and he came to put down the rebellion, and he came to put it down with a vengeance and with a cruelty and with a finality. Not only to teach the Jews a lesson, but to knock out of the minds of anybody else in his kingdom the idea that somehow you could cross Nebuchadnezzar, or you could cross the Babylonian Empire, and nothing would happen. Well, he was going to make certain that you knew that something was going to happen. So the facts of the matter are that in the spring of that year, I've discussed with you on a much earlier tape at the beginning of the history series, a question of the dates, the dates that are involved here. But most historians agree that the year we're talking about is the year 586 before the Common Era. And in the spring of that year, Nebuchadnezzar came from the north, and he invaded the outposts of Judah, and by the early part of the summer, his army had encamped around the city. And his strategy was, the time-honored strategy of the stronger army, siege and attrition, just to wear the enemy down. And he brought his siege machines, he brought the lines of the siege closer and closer. And in the Tanakh, it is recorded that on the ninth day of the month of Tammuz, the walls of the city were weakened sufficiently that the Babylonian army was able to invest the walls and come into the city. The second Khurban, the walls of the city buckled on the 17th of Tammuz. And the fast day that we commemorate is that of the Second Temple, not of the First Temple. In fact, after the destruction of the First Temple, when the Jews were able to return 70 years later and rebuild the temple and rebuild their government, so even Tisha B'Av was canceled. Even the fast day of Tisha B'Av was canceled as a national fast day. It was restored with a vengeance, unfortunately, after the Second Temple. But the ninth day of Tammuz, which is not a particularly joyful day on our calendar, is not the day of the walls in the First Temple. It's the day of the walls being destroyed in the second, breached in the Second Temple. So his army arrived, and under the command of Nebuzaradan, his general, who was a fearsome person. His reputation for cruelty and butchery went before him, and his army took hold in the city, and within a month they had destroyed all pockets of Jewish resistance. And the Jews who could fled. Tens of thousands died in the siege, in the hunger and pestilence, and by the sword and by fire. Thousands of them fled. Many of them attempted to flee to Egypt, to the south. And many of them were allowed to flee by the Babylonians, who then just waited for them and herded them together into giant slave camps where they would transport them into the exile into Babylonia. Our rabbis tell us that the ninth day of Av, the at sunset of the beginning of the ninth day of Av. Again, here we're talking of the first temple. Babylonians purposely set fire to the building. Now, the second temple was even more fireproof than the first. But the first also, to a great extent, was a building of stone and of marble, and should not have burned easily. But apparently the accelerant that was used to set fire was of such a nature that it got the fire so hot that even the stones burned. The building collapsed in the fire. And it burned the entire day of the ninth of Av as well. Our tradition is, according to the Talmud in the Gemara Tainis, is that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed on the fire began on Motzoi Shabbos. In other words, Tisha B'Av was on a Sunday. And that the fire began at the end of Shabbos, that as night fell, and that the Beis HaMikdash burned all day Sunday, and it was destroyed completely. In its destruction, many of the artifacts of the Beis HaMikdash were captured, and many of them disappeared. The Talmud tells us, and we read in the Megillah of Esther, that Ahasuerus had inherited, when the Persians and the Medes conquered the Babylonians, they inherited the museums and the treasure houses of the Babylonians. And amongst the booty that they inherited were kalim of the Beis HaMikdash, were utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. Cups, goblets, golden objects, which they preserved. These items are referred to v'kelim mikelim shonim, it says in the Megillah. Then we read those three words with the melody of Eicha to indicate that those were the utensils that were used by Ahasuerus, and he used them for the banquet that he invited all the Jews to attend. And because he had to have kosher food and kosher utensils, he took the utensils of the temple, and then you had the irony of a generation of Jews participating in a banquet honoring Ahasuerus, the Persian emperor, by drinking from the utensils of their own Beis HaMikdash, which was destroyed and the utensils were captured. One of the many ironies of Jewish history. In any event, the destruction of the temple was complete, and the destruction of the government was complete, and the destruction of the country was complete, and the Jews were taken away into exile. That's the story, that's the simple historic fact of what happened. But to say that is not to understand what happened, and certainly not to be able to deal with it in the context that Jewish history and that Chazal have always dealt with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. That is, as I mentioned before, in a cosmic fashion. Let me give you a few ideas that I want to discuss, and I think it'll help make the matter clearer. First of all, you had a complete unbelievable thing happen, that God destroyed his own house. That God, so to speak, if one could use such a phrase, God contributed to what in effect was a denigration of God. Because the Beis HaMikdash was in existence for over four centuries. It was world famous. It was one of the wonders of the ancient world. Everybody knew that the Jews were different. Everybody knew that the Jews were monotheists in a world of paganism. And here, the God of monotheism, so to speak, allows himself to be defeated by the pagans. He allows Nebuchadnezzar, who is a pagan ruler and the representative of all that is evil, to somehow triumph and burn down God's house. Now, that's one of the great questions in history. That's the same type of question as the Holocaust raises. It's the same type of question that Job raises on a personal level. How does God let that happen? Where is God to defend himself? And no matter what the Jews were, and I'm going to discuss with you the negative attributes of the Jewish people which led to the destruction of the temple, but no matter what they were, they weren't worse than the Babylonians. So why should the Babylonians win? Why should God allow his own house to be destroyed? Now that is a tremendously difficult philosophic matter to deal with. And the Churban made that matter real. Now, that one of the reasons, you see it in the words of all of the commentators to the Tanakh, one of the reasons why the Jews never took seriously the prophecies of Yeshayahu, let us say, or Yirmiyahu, or Micha, or any of the other prophets who time and time again foretold the destruction of the temple. It isn't that it was a surprise to them. For at least 150, if not 200 years, they had been constantly warned that it's coming, that the temple will be destroyed, and the Jewish government will come to an end, you're all going to go into exile. They had been told that the words that appear in the Chumash and the Tochacha and the terrible predictions of the troubles, that those words are literally true. It's going to happen. Why didn't the Jewish people believe it? Well, first of all, the nature of a person is that we are, even the worst pessimist is, by being human, an optimist. The Jewish people thought that it was perhaps hyperbole, it was exaggeration, it was poetic license, or it wasn't going to happen to them. You know, it's going to happen 100 years from now. It's a little like the national debt. We all know it's going to plots, but as long as it doesn't plots while I'm around, you know, so who cares? You know, meanwhile, I'm driving my car and I have my house, and, you know, and America's America, so, yeah. It's very hard to sell people on the fact that they have to preserve something for their grandchildren or for the next generation. People aren't going to stop driving their automobiles because of the ozone layer, because 100 years from now it's going to be hot and the country will be... No, people don't think that way. The mere fact that we are mortal, and we know we are mortal, and we know that our mortality is limited at the outside to a century. So if I tell you, you know, 350 years from now there's going to be a disaster, and no one will be nervous about it. Chazal comment that was one of the reasons why Noah didn't have much of a following either. He said, 120 years are going to be the mob. Oh, 120 years will be the mob. You know, 120 years Chicago Cubs will win the pennant. I mean, that's not a problem to us. It's not relevant to us. And therefore people don't listen. So even those that were willing to listen to the prophets felt that it's not going to be now. Yeah, there's no question that the Churban is going to come, but it's not going to come now. But the main reason why they didn't listen is because they said God cannot afford it. So to speak, the Jews had God blackmailed. How can God do that? We're the only people he has on the world. And we at least officially subscribe to his brand of monotheism. and we at least are, we're the best that he's got around. It could be, it could be that we're only C plus, but it's better than nothing. And this temple has got not only God's name on it, his presence, Kaviochel, is there. Every day there are regular miracles. In the first temple, the miracles were apparent to all. The candelabra never was extinguished. The fire on the altar always crouched like a lion. All sorts of miracles. And in Pirkei Avos, we read of the miracles that exist in the second temple. So God is there. So how do you, God isn't going to be counterproductive. He's going to allow his building to be destroyed. And therefore, to a certain extent, we can do whatever we want. Because what's he going to do, right? It's like the son that's working in his father's business. So the son can embezzle and cheat and not show up on Monday mornings and do a lousy job and everything, because what's the old man going to do, right? The name of the company, it's Jones and Son. What's he going to do? Going to kick him out? He's got him. Well, that's how the Jewish people felt about God. They felt that they had him. And because of that, therefore, the destruction of the temple was a great philosophic shock to the Jewish people. And in a very perverse and different fashion, you have to understand that the destruction of the temple and the survival of the destruction of the temple was a triumph of the spirit of the Jewish people. That the Jewish people didn't walk away completely, that they looked at it the way they did look at it in terms of self-improvement and in terms of continuity and survival is a testimony to the great faith of the Jewish people and to their deep philosophic insight, because on the surface, lesser people would have been more than happy to write the whole thing off and forget it, and which would have been the end of the Jewish people, which, if the rules of history were followed, that undoubtedly would have happened. So that's the first point. And we have to realize the cosmic philosophic problem raised. Now we were dealing with a different God. Until now, we always knew that, that God meant it and God punished and God did this and God did that and you didn't trifle with God. But we never dealt with a God that would burn his own building. And our rabbis say it in their inimitable fashion. You have to listen to the words of the rabbis in the Talmud, not just what they say, but how they say it, the nuance. The Talmud in Brochus tells us that what does God say every day? What does God have to say about it? Which is always the question of the rabbis. Everything that happens in this earth, so we know what the New York Times has to say about it, and we know what CBS News has to say about it, and we know what we have to say about it, and you know what the guys in the mikveh Friday afternoon have to say about it, and the guys Shabbos between the parshas, we know what everybody has to say about it, but the ultimate question is, what does God have to say about it? What does he say about it? So the rabbi said that he said, "Oy labonim, woe to children shebi avonoseim, that because of their sins hechrafti as besi v'sarafti as hecholai, that I destroyed my own house and I burned down my own temple." So the rabbis did not avoid the issue; they met it head on. God destroyed his own temple. God burned down his own house. How can you make somebody do that? Well, that gives us an understanding of the power of sin. It gives us an understanding of the dimension of rebellion that exists within man. And the rabbis therefore compared it, not in an unlikely fashion, but compared it to the destruction of the world at the time of the flood, of the Mabul, which was really the clue to God's, and is the clue to God's behavior. So there also, how did God, it says in the Torah that God said, Nichamti, Kaviyochel, the Torah expresses itself in such a term that God expressed himself that I'm sorry I created man and who needs the world and, you know, and let it rain. What do you mean, let it rain? You set the whole thing up, that the world is so complicated. It's so, the laws of physics, of nature, of ecology, of biology, of botany, it's just mind-boggling. What do you mean, let it rain? God said, let it rain, that's it. It's not worth it. Without man, it's not worth it. There's a purpose to the world. The purpose of the world is man. Without man, who cares? Well, that was a lesson. That's a lesson that's burned into the psyche of man. And now there's a lesson for the Jewish people. God doesn't need a temple. God doesn't care about his reputation, so to speak. And God doesn't care about his house or anything else. If the Jewish people behave in such a fashion that they are really not my people and they take me for granted and they take history for granted and they're not at all attuned to what's happening in the world, so then, you know, so who needs it? So then it's only sticks and stones and bricks and mortar. That's all destructible. So what? And that's a profound, profound revelation to us. Not only that God could do it, he did it. Not only did he do it once, he did it twice. Not only did he do it twice, but in lesser ways, he's done it many times to us. That should give the Jewish people some pause. Because we, I always have this feeling, and I don't mean to be political, even though I am, but, you know, people say, never again. What? We're not going to let it happen. Those are, you know, that's whistling past the graveyard. Because it's not up to us, never again. What guarantee, what if you... If you gave every Jew in the world an Uzi submachine gun, and I'm certain there are now enough Uzi submachine guns in circulation that you could do that, it wouldn't stop never again. We all know that deep down in our heart. And we know that man can destroy himself and destroy the whole world. Doesn't take much. In our time, it takes very little. Takes two fingers on two buttons and it's all over. But that's an awesome realization. To live in such a dangerous world, especially if one is a Jew, to live in such a dangerous world. But it is the Churban more than anything else that is impressed upon Jewish history and the Jewish mind, that reality. And because the reality is so frightening, we always tend to ignore it. We always tend not to deal with it. I think that that's part of the mystique, if I can use that word, regarding Tisha B'Av, is the fact that Tisha B'Av, it's not just a day of mourning, it's a day of such terrible reality that that's what causes the mourning. You know, the famous Rebbe of Kotsk said that there really are no fast days on the Jewish calendar. He says the two fast days of Tisha B'Av and Yom HaKippurim, so he said, Yom Kippur, who wants to eat? Everybody, you're such a spiritual person on that day, so who wants to eat? And Tisha B'Av, he said, who can eat? Right? If you realize what it is, you have no appetite. That's really what Tisha B'Av is. Tisha B'Av came, the Churban came to point out to you what, you know, what the reality really is. And not what the delusions that one can convince oneself of are. That's really not productive for us. So that's one point. Another point is that the rabbis saw that the Jewish people themselves caused the Churban. It's not a hard and fast rule in history that the Babylonians have to triumph over the kingdom of Judah. Now, good old Karl Marx and his buddies in the 19th century sold Western civilization, amongst all the other garbage that they put upon us, the idea that there are rules of history, inflexible, inexorable rules of history, and that the individual under no circumstance can change those rules, and that we are just pawns. Now, if you think about it, that justifies, you know, sending 50 million people to the gulag, and it justifies starving 100 million Chinese. Because it's, you know, it's the wave of the future. You can't stay in the way of progress. It's got to happen. And if it's got to happen, then, you know, I'm just helping it happen. I'm not doing it. It is the idea of the Western world in the last 150 years that there are historic forces that create these cataclysms and holocausts and disasters really acquits us of all responsibility. That's exactly what everybody, you know, it's not my fault. Right? I only was taking orders. I'm only doing what history says. And that's what allows us to be such murderers. Because there is no individual guilt or responsibility. We are all acting under a force. Like the weather forecaster that predicts a tornado or a hurricane, he is not guilty when the tornado comes or the hurricane comes and kills innocent people. He, you know, he's a scientist. He told you it was going to come. So too, the nature of the view of history is that all of these things are inevitable. It has to happen. The big have to devour the small. The weak have to fall before the strong. And that there are forces in history and civilizations rise and fall, and that's it. And that, in effect, if we follow the logic of Western civilization to its illogical conclusion, which a lot of people do, Western civilization is doomed. The United States and the Western world generally is no different than Rome, or the Holy Roman Empire, or the English Empire, or any other major power that has existed in the world. The most we can look forward to is being a second-rate country. That's if history will allow us to survive. But otherwise, we may even disappear. Wouldn't be the first time. And that, I think, goes also to explain part of the innate pessimism which exists in the Western world. The Western world is a very pessimistic place. If you have any doubts about it, just read the newspaper every day. It's just a very sad, pessimistic place. You know, now it's a hot summer, so, you know, so they all say that in 200 years the polar ice caps will melt and goodbye. Maybe they will, maybe they won't, but, you know, the trend of thought is always pessimistic. And that's built into us by this feeling that the age of reason and enlightenment gave us. The Torah came to say the opposite. The Torah has a different view of history. History can be altered. History can be changed. It can be changed by one man. It can be changed by one act. It can be changed by one people. What happens is because we are the ones that caused it to happen. We are not guiltless observers that are caught up in some great mob scene, which is called history. We are the participants. We are the players. We're the authors. We can do whatever we want. And therefore, the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the destruction of the temple, occurred because of the behavior of the Jewish people. The Jewish people brought it upon themselves. They could have prevented it. They could have prevented it even at the last minute. They could have prevented it. But they chose not to, for whatever reasons. And our rabbis list as the three cardinal reasons for the destruction of the first temple, the three major sins of society: paganism, the lack of faith in God, the lack of any allegiance to the higher authority, to the Creator that has fashioned us. Paganism need not be translated only in terms of idols. It's not just Zeus and Apollo. You know, paganism takes on many different forms in society. Wealth, greed, all sorts of injustice are all reflected in the ideas of paganism. Because we're not responsible to a God. And paganism also represents the fact that God is like man. And the Torah came to say that man was created in the image of God. So in all the mythologies of all the pagan religions in the world, from the Eastern to the Western to the Northern religions, the gods behave like men, and like bad men, like spoiled, rich, bad men. They fight among themselves, they kill each other, they steal each other's wives, they do terrible things, because the mythology has portrayed the god as man. And the Torah came to say that man has to make himself as God. Mahu chanun, afato chanun. God is merciful, you have to be merciful. God visits the sick, you have to visit the sick. You have to try and imitate God, the great concept of imitatio Dei, of imitating the Creator. So that sin, that was a terrible sin, doomed to destroy the Jewish people. Then the second sin was shvichas domim, that it was a society that placed little value on human life, which is another horrendous view of man, which in our time also, you know, human life is cheap. And we're inured to it. We become immune to even, I knew I was going to lecture tonight, so in the 2.5 minutes that I prepared, I listened to the news. So in the city of New York today, there were 8 murders. 8 murders, and 5 people died on Sunday in a fire that was set, that they think was arson. Yeah, so, you know, nothing. I'm waiting to hear the baseball score. This guy's telling me about 8 guys that got to get one of us heart mirror, you know. Why is it my business? Because we're immune to it. We are absolutely immune to it. Human life. And if that's true by us, in the Western world where we at least pride ourselves on some sort of civilization, in other societies it is far worse. I once read a statistic in a National Geographic magazine that in Calcutta, India, there are 300 people that die every night in the streets. If you multiply that by 365 days, my math is not good, but it's a big, big number. And yeah, that's it. That's the way it is. And the acceptance of that type of situation, acceptance of, they just finished, I don't know if they finished, but they're taking a breather in the Iraq-Iran war, right? 1 million people killed in 8 years, yama. And this madman that's running Iran, so he says it's the most bitter pill of his life that he has to stop the killing. Like to keep it going further. Why? Because that's because human life doesn't mean anything. Causes mean more. Everything means more. In the Torah, nothing means more than human life. And the instances when human life can be taken are very limited. and have to meet certain very exacting standards. And because of that, therefore, when human life is taken very easily, so then, again, is a reflection on society. And finally, our rabbis say the third sin was that of sexual immorality, which again is the the loss of understanding of the role of people in the world and of the role of the human body and of the necessity to appreciate the grandeur of the person instead of making out of the person a little more than an animal. So when they had those three things together, and they had it together for a long time, it isn't that it just happened. And those were the ills of society about which the prophets complained over and over again, and the Jewish people turned a deaf ear. So then the Churban was inevitable. Not because it was inevitable due to historic forces that were at work. It was inevitable because of the behavior of the Jewish people. And the Jewish people can and did do something about it. At least in those matters, there was some improvement. In the Second Temple, for instance, paganism was not as popular, murder wasn't as popular, and even immorality, which is the most popular of all, was not as popular. They did do something about it. The famous statement from Rav Kook that the British Governor General or High Commissioner Lord Stars said to him that he doesn't see any improvement in civilization over the thousands of years. So the British General had an office that overlooked the valley of Gay Hinnom, the valley of Hinnom outside the walls of Jerusalem. And Rabbi Kook pointed out to him, he said, you see in that valley, he said, 2700 years ago, my ancestors took children and burned them to the idols. Took their own children and burned them to the idols. He says, that we don't do anymore. So there is some improvement. It may have taken us 2,700 years, but at least with that lesson we learned. And the idea, therefore, that man himself could do something to improve himself, has to do something, the Churban made that real. The destruction of the temple made that real. Another idea about the destruction of the temple, which is, excuse me, again, part of this idea, is that a change in nature occurred after the destruction of the temple. Just as a change in nature, according to many of the commentators, the Ramban and others, occurred after the Mabul. The Ramban says in the Chumash we see that man became carnivorous, animals became carnivorous after the Mabul. The nature of human beings changed, the nature of nature changed. Well, after the Beis HaMikdash also, Chazal say, for instance, that the blue sky was taken away. There is no blue sky anymore after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Can't see really blue sky anymore. The rabbis say very strongly that certain pleasures in life, including physical pleasures in life, the marital relations, etc., the rabbis say that from the Churban Beis HaMikdash on, that was taken away. The enjoyment of it was taken away. It became less enjoyable, more mechanical. And the rabbis in their wisdom said that the only ones who retain the joy of it are those that do it illicitly. But it was taken away. It doesn't exist anymore. The rabbis tell us that certain tastes in fruit and vegetables, and that's before they managed to have the tomatoes taste like the cartons that they come in. But the taste was taken away. The world changed. That was the message. The Churban, therefore, was not just the Churban for the Jewish people. The world changed. God, so to speak, withdrew. And that's how the rabbi saw it. Previously, God had a house and he lived there, so to speak, right? We'll take a bad example, but something that perhaps will give us some focus on the matter. Let's say you live on a block, and on that block lives a great wealthy man, a very powerful man. So the block is it's a different kind of block. First of all, you know, they plow the street first in the snow, and the garbage guys always come, and everybody takes care of their lawn because there's such a nice lawn next to it. You live in Tobacco Road, right? Everybody's a slob, so after a while it gets to you too. Well, let's, again, as a bad example, but that's how the rabbi saw it. You know, their bonus shalom, God was in the neighborhood, right? He lived there. He lived in Jerusalem. He lived in Eretz Israel. He lived amongst the Jewish people. He lived in the world. So if he lived in the world, so it was a different world. It had to be a different world, a world where you could every day see a physical manifestation, kaviyochel, of God's presence. And now God withdrew. They moved out of the house, wrecked the house, left. So the block is not the same. And it's never going to be the same. Until and unless, you know, you're able to rebuild that situation. Now, rabbis therefore said that the second temple never equaled the first temple. The same feeling never came back. Things were different. Physically different. And our rabbis say the Jew never fell the same. Little things. Our rabbis also say people were different. It says, Botlu posku anshe amono mi Yisrael, it says, the Gemara in Sota. There were no longer trustworthy people, right? As long as God was around, so man also, you could find trustworthy people. But after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, became very, very difficult to find. The rabbis say that song, music, changed, became inferior. There was a type of glass crystal that existed called Zchuchis Levono. We don't know what that is, but it was apparently a rare type of crystal, that of glass that they knew how to make, and that existed, and that disappeared. And they had a type of popsicle made out of wine. They called it Yain Korush, frozen wine. That was the delicacy of the world. That also disappeared. The rabbis didn't come here to describe the menu. They didn't come to tell us, you know, these little... They came to tell us that it was a different world. And because it was a different world, then everything has to be seen in that light as a different world. Also, the access to God was different. Previously, there was an easy way out, so to speak, right? If a person sinned, so he brought the method of service to God through animal sacrifices, through the Beis HaMikdash, was foolproof. It was a Beis HaMikdash, there were Kohanim, there was a ritual. A person could cleanse himself, a person could come close to God, he could get the appointment. Now we have to rely on prayer. Prayer is a much more difficult route. It requires a great deal more effort on the part of the person, and even when the effort is there, you have no guarantee that the call is ever completed. You have no idea. Neshalma Purim Sfaseinu. Our lips become the sacrifice. They become the method of reaching God. So on one hand, that's exalted. But on the other hand, it is a much more difficult route to travel. And our rabbis therefore compared all sorts of tragedies to the Churban Beis HaMikdash. That's not an accidental comparison. Our rabbis say, for instance, that if a person, God forbid, loses a spouse, that's Kiyom Shechor Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because life is never the same afterwards. The person will go on living, the person may even remarry, everything, but it's never the same. That's gone. Our rabbis tell us, Rachmana Litzlan, that if a person loses a child, so that's a scar that never heals. People live afterwards, people are productive, people even laugh, but that never goes away. It's never the same again. Our rabbis tell us, righteous people depart the world. So that's comparable to the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Again, what's that idea? It's never the same. Churban Beis HaMikdash means it's never the same. It's not, you know, it's not losing the Super Bowl. It's not even losing money. It's never the same. And therefore, that was one of the lessons, so to speak, that the Churban had to impress itself upon the Jewish people. Our rabbi saw that in relationship to the creation of the world itself. I discussed with you in the previous tapes when I discussed creation, that the rabbi said that God created worlds and destroyed them, created worlds and destroyed them. The world that we're in now is not necessarily the first world, and it may not necessarily have always looked this way. But that there was a process of destruction, and once that destruction occurred, it was never the same again. Things changed, and they changed irrevocably. And the ultimate comparison the rabbis make, is to original man, to Adam Arishon, to original man. Original man lived in the Garden of Eden. He was God's protege, so to speak, and he lacked for nothing, and he lived forever, and all human frailties were removed from him, and he knew nothing of the mortal condition which is endemic to all creatures. And then by sinning he was exiled from the garden. And he was exiled from the garden. God used the language Ayeka, where are you? Which is the same word as Eicha, which is the word regarding the Churban. So the rabbis compared the two, and they said that the Churban to the Jewish people, the destruction of the temple vis-a-vis the Jewish people and their history, is to be seen in the same fashion as the exile of man from the Garden of Eden regarding the human condition. You have a completely different condition now. And now you have a condition of having to wrest a living from the recalcitrant soil. You have to sweat for everything that you have. You're mortal with a knowledge of mortality that always terrorizes you. The problems of life are real. That's what the Churban Beis HaMikdash did for the Jewish people. It was a defeat. It was a complete change of nature, complete change of how the world functioned, how to live in that world now. And therefore, we operate differently. A rabbi said that a great deal of knowledge was lost. We don't have the intellect we once had. Nitla eitzo mimeno, the words of the rabbis, our ability to decide things. One of the reasons why we never have criminal justice outside of the Sanhedrin, because the Sanhedrin required the presence of the temple in terms of criminal justice. There's no temple, then we don't have the wisdom to deal with those matters. It's just beyond us. So we are talking here again about this fundamental difference between the world that had a temple and the world that didn't have a temple. And all of that came to rest when this happened. Finally, our rabbis say that as long as Yirmiyahu stayed in the city, the temple could not be destroyed. The power of one righteous person. Again, we hear that often in the words of the rabbis, that, for instance, the Mabul, the flood on the world, as long as Methuselah was alive, as long as Meshuselah was alive, so then the flood didn't come. He died. God waited till the Shiva was over, and that was it. As long as Yirmiyahu was in the city, so even with all of the crime and all the sins and all the weaknesses of the Jewish people, couldn't do it. He was enough to protect. But when he went out of Yerushalayim, the words of the Psikta are, Kivan Sheyotzo Yirmiyahu Yerushalayim, the moment Yirmiyahu left the city, Yorad HaMalach Min HaShemayim, Mad HaMalach came down from heaven, the heavenly force came down and split the walls, and said, Yavo Asonim V'yichnesu Lebeis Sheadono Eino Besocho. Yirmiyahu's not here, God is not here. If the owner of the house isn't here, the robbers can come and plunder it. Open season. So again, we have the idea that the Churban is dependent on one person, on a few people. And the presence of a few people can prevent it. I have mentioned to you many times the fact that the rabbis point out to us that the city of Sdom was destroyed because of the lack of 10 righteous people, not because of the presence of 3 million evil people. If there would have been 10 righteous people, then God can suffer, so to speak, the 3 million evil people. But when there are not righteous people in the town, when there isn't dominion, so to speak, when nobody around is good, so then it's open season, right? Then God's protective hand, which guides everything in history, that is removed. When that's removed, then everything is removed. Then everything is expendable. Then it makes no difference. Even God's house is accessible to the enemy. Finally, the point I want to make is that the Jewish people were able to realize that the temple could be rebuilt, if not in brick and stone, and not in the same way, but it could be rebuilt by themselves. Ein lo lakodesh baruch hu ba'olomo el adal arama shel alocha bilvad. Now that the temple was destroyed, then God could still find a place. He could find a place in the hearts of the Jewish people. He could find a place in their synagogues. He could find a place in their houses of study. He could find a place in their behavior. They would build an imaginary temple until the time would come when God in his own fashion would rebuild again a physical, real temple for them. But the ability to build an imaginary temple, that to a great extent is much harder and a much greater accomplishment than to build a physical temple. It's much easier to build a building than to build what's in the building. It's much easier. We see that regarding education. We have some of the finest school plants in the world, but it's very hard to produce one human being from that plant that it should work. It's easy. There are beautiful, beautiful houses of worship all over the world that are just glorious to behold. But it's hard to build an imaginary house of worship. It's hard to build a place where God is really welcome and where man really can accomplish. And that idea, the destruction of the temple, brought home to the Jewish people. And the Jewish people, therefore, again, to their everlasting credit and to the greatness of Israel, have been able to rebuild the temple in miniature, in a different fashion, in different communities, in different circumstances, over the centuries, in all different continents in the world. But the central idea, that remained. That gave them courage and strength, and it gave them purpose. And it spelled the difference between Jewish history and the history of the rest of the world. No other people could or has sustained such a blow, and not only survived it, but were able to carry on with their mission, and to carry on with their set program of accomplishment the way the Jewish people did. So that's why this destruction of the first temple has to be seen as really the watershed in Jewish history. Nothing is the same afterwards as it was before. But on the other hand, new opportunities, a new set of circumstances arose for Israel, which the Jewish people were able to take advantage of, and through that build themselves and guarantee their continuity and their survival and their eternity.